its forces. Iran's adversaries' intentions to isolate it have so far failed, since everyone can witness the country's wide political and economic relations with nations ranging from the Far East to Africa and Latin America. Now, putting us at Press TV on that list of Western wicked violation of human rights, violation of free trade, and violation of freedom of expression gives us great pride to be a voice of the truth that the West adamantly tries to silence but utterly fails yet again. Press TV proudly shall remain the voice of the voiceless.
Well, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Ms. Maryam Saleh in Beirut, university lecturer. It's a pleasure having you on board, Maryam, to discuss this issue. So we are now on the first anniversary of the death of Iranian Mahsa Amini, whose death was ruled by medical officials and professionals as being a result of a health complication. We see the West collectively come together once again to try and punish Iran at the level of its security, economy, technology, and even media for simply defending its national security and territorial integrity against systematic Western attacks once again. Now, as a media professional yourself, how effective do you view these attempts to try to control the narrative in favor of the Western schemes, if I may, against the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, these Western schemes, first, thank you for having me, Marwa, and it's great to be here. These Western schemes continue this is a decades-long battle, actually. This is not new. The U.S. has continued and tried everything from the beginning, from the success of the revolution in 1979, and they were continuously creating this rhetoric, launching campaigns, launching sanctions against the Islamic Republic. So, therefore, this is not new. And now it is not only targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran, it is targeting any country that stands with the Islamic Republic and goes by its stances of course, fight against oppression and injustice and so on and so forth. So, basically, we can see for those who do actually read, those who do follow up, those who want the news to come to them, they will be searching for it and they will be reaching it. Of course, they are successful somewhat in basically creating this blackout, perhaps for those who are in the United States, perhaps those who are in the Western world in general. They don't have enough access to alternative media. They don't have that access to be able to get the other side of the story. Even websites are blocked. And so it's crazy in a world where we have such all this technology, where we should be capable of reaching every single person in the entire globe. You still cannot reach everyone, but of course you still do have a lot of people who are critical, but unfortunately they are still few. There are few people who are critical of their country's politics, the few people who want to get to the story. But of course, when you come and see what's happening, they are in control somewhat, but when you see how crazy it is, it's these double standards. Mm-hmm. We have mass killings by the police in the United States. You have killings in France. You have all the suppression also in the Western world. And the fact that freedom of speech is actually being distorted, the word freedom of speech, you are not allowed to speak about Islam and the Quran, but you are allowed to speak about other issues that would lead to chaos and would lead to corruption of the entire society. So basically, they do have that control in several areas, but at the same time, you have this part of the world. You have those people, even in other parts of the world, who are raising awareness, who are educating people on a daily basis, and we do know them. We have a lot of figures in the Western world, both in the Americas, and you have a lot of countries that are resisting bit by bit.
Maryam, you yourself, being part of Press TV's team since it was launched in 2007, and I find it crucial for the audience to hear it firsthand, coming from a highly respected journalist and a colleague that I personally learned a lot from. What does it mean to you to see Press TV targeted like this by the Western illegal punitive measures, while knowing that on a daily basis our work at Press TV focuses on seeking out the truth while they are killing the truth, aka you have the biggest journalist that has been under oppression for more than 10 years right now, Julian Assange, in prison, and he's about to be sentenced for like 150 years, and they say nothing about it.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right, and this is a big injustice. Actually, this is a huge injustice. When we began in 2007, we clearly said we're going to give the platform for everyone. It's true that we are focusing on what is happening, on all the injustice, all the aggressive policies against the Palestinians, which is a primary issue for us. It's a priority, but we are even giving platform to Zionists. We were allowing everyone to give their take, making sure that we were not like Western media. We're not silencing anyone. And we even, for example, in 2007, you probably know the mayhem that was in Lebanon, all the political complications. We still, those who were anti, for example, resistance, we gave them a platform. We made sure that we get their opinion, as we get the opinion of resistance supporters on our platform as well. We also spoke to everyone else. So therefore, we were quite surprised when we saw in the beginning, even before this, this is not the first form of sanctions. We had previous sanctions when we were taking down satellites, we were taking down websites. Our websites were closed, especially by the United States, of course, administration. That was the main side that is fighting against the media, which is really successful. And I think that the main reason why they are targeting Press TV and those media outlets in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and perhaps in turn as they are doing in other countries, as in Lebanon, it is mainly because they are succeeding and reaching out to those who do want the truth. And like I said, we all want the truth. We had correspondents in every single corner of the world. And those correspondents were always under attack. They were always censored. They were always not given permission.
They were
not allowed.
Life for the truth. If you remember our own Serena Shim, who gave her life to show the world that the World Health Organization was bringing weapons and insurgents into Syria, and she never came back to her family.
Exactly. That was one of the facets of the truth that we were trying to show. And still, she paid her life for that sake. Her family lost her, but she knew that this was a message that she needed to take out. And this is what our journalists are doing every day. We also had another journalist who was killed directly by Daesh in Syria as well. So therefore, we are always journalists that are ready to seek the truth, as you said, no matter what the cost. And that is what is surprising, because like I said, we're trying to make sure that the truth comes out to everyone, and it seems that Press TV was quite successful in this very clearly. And this is when you see that the United States is fighting you and targeting you, that means that you are on the right track, and this is something that we learned
That's
throughout
100%
the years.
Right, but as a media and communications lecturer yourself, what really raises concern for me is the power that our enemy has against us. And do you think that such an approach will oblige the international community, especially the global South communities, to adopt maybe the Western culture of journalism because they are afraid that they might face something like Press TV have been facing?
Well,
for the
unfortunately, you do have a lot of media outlets that are forced to do that. And when you come and look at what media is about, you have a lot of critical analysts that stress that what media is all about in the last decades, especially since the fact that we had a uniformal method when it comes to media, it's mainly to create ideologies. And they're not just, and in order to do that, they need to distort and destroy other ideologies, people's cultures, people's identities. And that is what they have been doing in all those decades, especially after the victory of the revolution in the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979. So that was their main issue or main objective. And that was not only done in our part of the world, that was done also in other parts of the world. They are trying to create those ideologies, and through that, they incite hatred, they incite stereotyping, and this is something we saw firsthand. I grew up in the United States. I saw how people looked at Lebanon. Oh, those poor, unfortunate people, they have to be living under terrorists, and they did not know that we were living under Israeli occupation that was supported by the United States administration. And that is something that we need to let out to the rest of the world, and still we have a lot of people who are ignorant to those ideas and that reality, and this would probably take a lot of time and more time, but we are getting getting there somehow.
Well, with people like you, Maryam, ladies and gents, Maryam Saleh, university lecturer and a dear colleague and friend, with people like her, we make sure that the voices of the voiceless is always heard. I want to thank you very much, Maryam, for being with us in this segment to talk about the new batch of sanctions against us. Ladies and gents, thank you very much. Stay tuned next week for more updates from West Asia right here on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Tonight, as we continue in this series of this pure life, this Islamic life, I want to take our minds and our discussion to the next level and look at a topic which is really the foundational block of this religion of Islam. And that is about Tawheed, what we would very, very roughly translate as monotheism, the oneness of God. You know, this theory of Tawheed, which we have to again internalize and manifest it, it's probably best seen in our teachings given to us by the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, in the du'as that we recite. You know, one of the tragedies of our era and many of our communities, especially when we don't understand the language of the du'as, the Arabic of the imams, peace be upon them, is we read these du'as, but we only read them to get to the end of the du'a. You know, how many communities I've been to that don't understand a word of Arabic, but yet Thursday night comes and we recite du'a kumail. Now, I'm not doubting on the power of du'a kumail in Arabic. I'm not saying we don't read it, but I'm saying that if we don't understand the language, A, we have to begin to teach and learn the Arabic of the Quran, of the du'as, and while we're on that path of trying to learn the Arabic of the imams, how they communicated to Allah, we need to begin to learn to read these du'as in a language we can understand. Or at least to have, let's say, a PowerPoint presentation with translations that we can read as the Arabic is going on. Because I guarantee you, brothers and sisters, that the du'as of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, were we to understand them, we would have a radically different understanding of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because this is all the du'as are about. The du'as that the imams taught, and even what the Prophet taught, are never about themselves. You look at Du'a Kumail, a masterpiece. Where do you see Imam Ali talking about himself in the Du'a? He doesn't talk about himself at all. He doesn't even talk about the Prophet in the Du'a. Yes, at the very end we send salawat on the Prophet because that is a recommendation in the Du'a to bless, ask Allah to bless the Prophet. But from beginning to end, Imam Ali is only communicating with Allah and getting you and I to recognize the oneness of Allah within the du'a. You know, there's this portion, let me just mention it as I move on, where Imam says, As'aluka bihaqqika wa qudsik. I ask you, O Allah, by the right that you have, and by your greatness, by your sanctity, by your honor, by your majesty, wa a'dhami sifatika wa asma'ik, and by the greatness of your characteristics, your qualities, your traits, and your names. He says, "Antaj'alani awqat, antaj'ala awqati fil layli wan nahari bi dhikrika ma'mura." He's saying to Allah, "Allow my entire 24 hours, day and night, layl wan nahar, to be filled by your remembrance." That's tawheed, that my entire day should be in remembrance. But let me ask you, does the imam, is he saying that I take my prayer beads out and I'm at work and I'm counting, subhanallah, subhanallah, subhanallah. I'm driving in my car and I'm taking out the prayer beads and doing the dhikr of Allah. Is this what the imam means, that my day and night is in a constant remembrance of Allah by these little prayer beads that I you know, buy when I go for ziyarah? No, he's not saying that. Yes, that is one manifestation of the dhikr of Allah, is to take out the prayer beads and enumerate the names of God. But more importantly, as hadith tell us, is when we recognize that every instant of our lives, Allah is watching over us. That, the imams tell us, is the greatest dhikr of Allah. When I recognize that when I'm at school, I could be cheating on an exam, but I remember that Allah is ever present. Alam ya'lam bi anna Allah yara, as the Quran says. Do we not know that Allah is ever watchful? That I don't cheat on my exam at school because I know Allah is witnessing it. I go to work and I have a customer and I'm charging him, I'm billing him by the hour. Do I bill him for 8 hours when I only did 5 hours of work and say, ah, it's okay, he's not going to know the difference? No, I remember that Allah has ever witnessed. I do the dhikr of Allah and I remember that Allah is witnessing. Why should I steal somebody's money? For a few dollars extra, I take in haram income into my life. Or I work at a company and I get half an hour break for lunch. And I say, you know what? I have to pray Dhuhr and Asr and eat. So I'm going to take an hour. And it's okay. It's a multinational. They're a big company. What's a half an hour to a big company like that? Or I take pens and paper, or I take a laptop and I don't return it back to work again and say, well, they're a kafir. They're non-believers. I can do what I want. No, at that stage, I do the dhikr of Allah and I say, Allah, I remember Allah. And I think, would Allah approve of this? Is this a manifestation of tawheed? Is this what Allah would expect? And I don't rip off my customers. I don't rip off my manager or the company I work for. Because I'm engaging, as Imam Ali says, antajala awqati fi layli wa nahari bi dhikrika ma'mura. I'm constantly in the dhikr of Allah, day and night, so I'm not going to steal or shortchange my customers or take from the companies whatever they have. Again, it's all about Allah and dua kumail. And then he says, wa bi khidmatika mawsula, allow me to be joined in your service, to always be in the service of Allah. Wa a'mali indaka maqbula, for my actions to be accepted. Hatta takuna a'mali wa awradi kulluha wirdan wahidan wa hali fi khidmatika sarmada. Where he says that allow my life, my works, my wird, as he says, wirdan wahida, means let every action that I do in my life, not just a wird as in a dua that I recite or a dhikr that I make, no, that everything I do from the time I wake up to the time I go to sleep, from the day that I become of age, become baligh, become baligha, I have that responsibility to God. Until the day I leave this world, allow me to be in your service and allow me to have, you know, to be on that path, not to deviate from the path of Tawheed. From these few lines of Dua Kamil, brothers and sisters, we can see Imam Ali is pointing us to Tawheed. And every line perhaps in the Dua can be looked at under the lens of Tawheed and how we live a monotheistic lifestyle. You know, we get to that point in life, inshallah, we make to that point before we leave this world, before we die, before we're in the ground, that every action that we do is for Allah. Our direction in life becomes Allah. Our direction is not this world or money or power or fame. No, those will come. But the goal and the direction in life becomes Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And as hadith tell us, that when you and I reform our relationship with Allah, Allah will ensure that our lives are reformed with this world. We serve Allah and this world will serve us. But the hadith tell us, if you serve this dunya, Allah will not allow His walaya, His authority to blanket us. We will be left to the people. We'll be left to the whims of society. We'll be left to the winds of change to blow us this way and that. And God forbid we get to that level where Allah allows us to be left alone to our own inklings and to be devoid of the walaya of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Kareem Azim Alim Halim Hakim Mateen Ghafur Shakur Wadud Qayyum Ra'uf Sabur Majid صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
7 barometric pressure.
Come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. One of the most important discussions that we have within the Holy Quran is the shan-e nuzul, that is, the reasons of revelation of certain verses. By understanding the reason of revelation of certain verses, we get a better understanding of the message that is intended by that particular verse. However, as I mentioned, it is not the meaning. You get a better understanding of a part of the meaning. The Holy Quran is an ocean, a bottomless ocean, if you like to say that, in terms of the verses and the meanings, as other hadiths tell us and traditions tell us. But there are certain verses that are very important, especially as a person who claims to be the follower of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And these particular verses also have, throughout history, created much debate, discussion amongst the followers of different schools within Islam. And one of those verses is the verse of purification, which is known as the Ayah of Tathir, which is the 33rd verse of the 33rd surah. That is the 33rd verse of surah Ahzab. And this particular verse, which we will obviously read inshallah in our next segment, has created great differences of opinions amongst the scholars. However, amongst the scholars of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, that is the Shia scholars, there is no difference and there is no debate of who this verse includes and who this verse excludes. And we have many different traditions that show and explain that this verse was revealed for these particular individuals. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be introducing the book that we'd like to introduce to our dear listeners, and obviously in the following segment, read a part of it for the benefit of them as well. So inshallah, please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is titled The Verse of Purification, a study of its intellectual and legislative aspects. This book was initially written in Arabic as Ayatul Tadhir, and it was written by the late Ayatollah Muhammad Mehdi Asifi, rahmatullah alayh. Ayatollah Asifi was once upon a time the General Secretary of the World Ahlul Bayt Assembly, Majma Jahani Ahlul Bayt, and was one of the activists against the Saddam regime, and he was sent from Najaf, his place of birth, to Iran, where he eventually passed away in the year 2015, but was taken and buried in the biggest Islamic cemetery, which is Wadi al-Salam in Najaf. So this book was translated by Abdullah Ahmed Zongo into English and was translated and was published by the Cultural and Translation section of the Ahlul Bayt World Assembly. Its first edition was published in 2012, and this particular printing house or this particular institution is in the holy city of Qom in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this is the book, The Verse of Purification. So the book has many different chapters. So for example, the first chapter is preface to the verse of purification. What is the introduction to it? What is important of it? The verse of purification itself and some explanation of the words within the verse. Then the third chapter deals with the verse of purification in the Shia, Masanid and Tafasir. So basically Masanid are, for example, the Hadith, and the Tafasir, obviously the Quranic commentaries and exegesis. Then if we continue, and that is the crux of the book. The book has those three sections, and this is what it aims to achieve. So basically the book tries to show that, you know, this verse, which is the verse of purification, whether you are a Shi'i or you are a Sunni, there is enough evidence to clearly show that this verse only refers to five individuals at that moment in time. Because there is hadith and traditions in both the Shi'i side and in the Sunni side. And then, obviously, as the title of the book suggests, it has specific legal issues, and intellectually it can also be said to be such. So hopefully this is the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today, and hopefully in our next segment we'll read a portion from it for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. The book that we introduced to our dear listeners in this episode was titled The Verse of Purification. It was written by Ayatollah Marhum Muhammad Mehdi Asifi and was translated into English by Sheikh Ahmed Zango. It was published by the Ahlul Bayt World Assembly in the year 2012. So we will read from the second chapter, which deals with the verse of purification itself. The verse of purification. Allah only desires to keep away uncleanliness from you, O people of the house, and to purify you, a thorough purification. So in Arabic, the verse reads, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم إنما يريد الله ليذهب أنكم رجس أهل البيت ويتحركم تتحيرا. Here we intend to carry out an analytical study of the holy verse of purification by highlighting the wording of this blessed verse. The word innama, which means only, which is in Arabic what is known as adatul hasr, meaning that it is a particular word that confines the ruling and the judgment of that sentence to a specific group of people or to a specific subject, or rather predicate, to be precise. The holy verse starts with the word innama, that is only, which is among the most powerful among adawat al-hasr, words indicating exclusiveness in Arabic. This word is used to confine what comes after it and negate anything else. There's a mistake in the translation. I corrected it. So the word is used to confirm what come after it and negate anything else is incorrect. For example, when we say innama al-faqiha Ali, only Ali is the jurist, we are confirming Ali is being authority on fiqh and negating it from anyone else. Ibn Manzur says in Lisan al-Arab, which is one of the most important books that deals with the Arabic language, innama confirms what comes after it and negates anything else, everything else. For example, when we say wa innama yudafi'u an ahsibihim ana aw mithlihim, we mean no one defends their account except I or the like of me. Therefore, exclusiveness, hasr, in Arabic has both positive and negative indications, without which the meaning of hasr will not be complete. Anyway, this discussion is a very vast discussion, extensive discussion, and as I mentioned, a historical discussion. It has been going on within the Islamic schools of thought for centuries. But hopefully, inshallah, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He enables us to truly understand the meaning of this verse and attach ourselves to those five members who are definitely part of this verse, which is the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, Bi Fatima to Zahra salamu alayha, Imam Hassan and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Inshallah, until next time, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
Occupy Wall Street was a movement against economic inequality, political corruption, the influence of money and the elite in politics, and the plight of the 99% versus the wealthy 1%. In September 2011, this grassroots movement drew people from different backgrounds to Zuccotti Park, located in Financial District in Lower Manhattan. Protesters demanded accountability for the 2008 U.S. financial crisis, criticizing Wall Street firms and large corporations for their role in the economic downturn. The movement died down relatively quickly, but Occupy Wall Street remains a symbol of grassroots activism in the United States. Occupy Wall Street. In the heart of New York City's financial district, a grassroots movement known as the Occupy Wall Street emerged in September 2011. The movement's primary aim was to address economic inequality and corporate influence in politics. Occupy Wall Street gained momentum through the use of social media, drawing in people from diverse backgrounds, camping out at Zuccotti Park in Manhattan, and refusing to leave. They criticized Wall Street firms and large corporations for their role in the 2008 economic crisis. The movement resonated with many Americans who felt left behind by a system they viewed as favoring the wealthy elite. Occupy Wall Street used the slogan, "We're the 99%, to highlight the vast wealth gap in the United States.
All the rich people are just hogging all their money and not giving any of it to people who actually need it.
They're out here, the 99%, and the 1% is controlling everything, financially everything. And that should not happen. Free up the jobs so people could work, economy could rise."
The "we are the 99%" phrase encapsulated the idea that most Americans were struggling while a small percentage enjoyed immense wealth. The protests spread to other cities, with similar encampments and demonstrations taking place across the nation. Occupy movements address various issues mostly relating to the economy, including student loan debt, healthcare, and affordable housing.
Occupy Wall Street, most people who have examined it closely believe that it was a response to the 2008 crash, that the issue of the neoliberal economic order was beginning to come to bear on the working class and the working poor. Many people associated with Occupy Wall Street were young people who had traditionally believed that they had the opportunity to have a better and more fruitful economic life than their parents. They were coming to the stark realization that the economic order that the United States Empire advocates and, in fact, enforces around the world was not in their best interest. So I don't believe they had a plan or they had a realistic idea of how to address their grievances, but they were angry. So it was an expression of anger. They moved into a number of parks and they attempted to act out against the government. Unfortunately, they didn't have a realistic plan. But yes, it was a response to the 2008 crash. And of course, I have to add this. It wasn't just the crash. It was the response to the crash. Because after the 2008 economic crash, there were two particular groups that had suffered. That would be the working class and the working poor. And of course, the extremely wealthy who owned the banks. And what they saw was that the government acted to relieve the economic burden of the super rich and did nothing to relieve the economic burden of the average working class person. And I believe that's what angered them.
The Occupy Wall Street movement began in September 2011 when protesters first occupied Zuccotti Park in New York City. The duration of the movement varied from city to city and camp to camp. In the case of the original Zuccotti Park occupation in New York City, it lasted for about 2 months. The protesters were eventually evicted from the park by authorities in mid-November 2011. What were the key motivations and goals of the Occupy Wall Street movement?
2011, the USA was still reeling from the aftermath of the financial meltdown of 2008 and 2009. And at the same time, there was a feeling that there needed to be some economic reforms in the United States to secure Americans the right to health care and jobs and education and regulate Wall Street transactions and Wall Street lending practices to offset the effects of the crisis and perhaps prevent another one from happening. However, there was a lot of opposition to that from the Republicans that had formed the Tea Party. And so it seemed that Occupy Wall Street was an attempt by those who wanted Wall Street to be regulated and wanted more economic reforms and wanted accountability from Wall Street and from the wealthy for the financial crisis to mobilize. And it ended up being a movement of hundreds of thousands of people, not just in New York City, but all across the United States, who moved into action and, you know, occupied public spaces, engaged in civil disobedience and arrests because they wanted Wall Street to be held accountable for the financial crisis, and they wanted some regulation and economic reforms.
Occupy Wall Street had its roots in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. The economic downturn had profound effects on millions of Americans, leading to job losses, home foreclosures, and growing sense of economic disparity. Frustration was brewing among the working and middle-class citizens who felt that the financial institutions responsible for the crisis had escaped accountability.
So let's not forget, it was a massive movement, and local groups often had to express different goals. But we can still pinpoint that its prime common concerns is how large corporations and the global financial system control the world in a way that benefits the infamous 1% or even 0.1%, undermines democracies and causes instability. So let's not forget that the slogan of the movement was, we are the 99%, and the hashtag was Occupy, of course.
Across the United States, the Occupy protests continued for several months, with some camps lasting longer than others. However, by early 2012, many of the physical encampments had been disbanded or had significantly diminished in size. While the physical occupations had a relatively short lifespan, the impact of the Occupy Wall Street movement on public discourse and activism persisted well beyond the time when the physical camps were active. What was the government response to the movement?
The government response initially was an attempt to take it over. At the time that Occupy Wall Street happened, I was doing some work on Capitol Hill with some people who were directly related to members of Congress. In fact, members of Congress and their representatives went to the locations. There were two, in fact, in Washington, D.C. There were a number of locations around the nation, not just in New York City, where there were the Occupy Wall Street movement had set up camps. So members of Congress, members of the ruling elite, actually sent their emissaries out to talk to the people to try to, in my opinion, to co-opt the movement, to go out there and basically say, what do you want? Let's move this anger into Congress, and let's trust Congress to act, to alleviate, to address your grievances. The people at Occupy Wall Street were not having it. They did not trust the members of Congress. They did not trust the members of the ruling elite. So they rejected the overtures by the congressional staffers and congressional emissaries.
The initial call for protests came from a Canadian anti-consumerist magazine called Adbusters. Callie Lance, an activist and co-founder of the magazine, called for a protest and a million-man march on Wall Street in February 2011. The actual protests, sit-ins and camping, came in September, and other groups and people joined the movement in mass when it gained some momentum and media attention.
Much of the protesters' anger is directed at the banks and financial industry. Several people went to a Citibank branch in New York where they planned to withdraw their money and leave, but the police were on the scene quickly and arrested about 20 people. Zuccotti Park is the birthplace of what is now a worldwide movement. This is where the call for global action originated. In Washington, large crowds gathered around the Martin Luther King Memorial. Demonstrators voiced their frustration with the country's stagnant economy and urged the government to take action to create jobs.
That is unacceptable. Not in this country. And not when these corporate fat cats are getting away with billions and billions of dollars.
After almost 2 months of protests, ironically, one of the world's richest people, the New York City mayor, Michael Bloomberg, ordered the city police to forcibly remove protesters and clear the park. Many were arrested, and many more were pepper sprayed. The New York City Police Department was accused of using police brutality against the Occupy Wall Street protesters.
Well, on the one hand, it seemed like the Obama administration was vocally supporting the Occupy Wall Street protests. Barack Obama, when he was dedicating the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial during the Occupy protests, he said that if Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. were alive today, he would be at Occupy Wall Street. Nancy Pelosi and other elected officials said they thought Occupy Wall Street was great. But we also know at the same time, they were coordinating a national security crackdown on the protests. There were calls with the mayors of major cities, the Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI not only heavily infiltrated the protests, but secured the arrest. There were many people that were arrested, beaten up, and injured. There were many protesters who spent time in prison. The most famous of which was probably Cecily McMillan, a friend of mine who ended up going to Rikers Island for almost a year simply because a police officer sexually assaulted her and she jumped in reaction. There was a heavy police crackdown. A lot of people were beaten up. A lot of people were maced in the face with pepper spray. There was a veteran in Oakland, California, who was shot in the head with a rubber bullet and sustained, permanent damage, to his ability to speak and his nerves as a result of that. There were many cases that involved various people that were brutalized, beaten up, injured, spent time in jail, etc.
The Occupy Wall Street movement did not have a single set of demands, but rather a range of concerns that resonated with a broad cross-section of society. However, some of the common themes and demands that emerged were about income inequality, corporate influence in politics, accountability for financial institutions, and social and economic justice. What were some of the criticisms aimed at the Occupy Wall Street movement?
They did not have a plan. They had no structure. They attempted to act in an anarchical way, and they didn't. So since they didn't have a plan, they didn't know what they were trying to accomplish. They were just acting out in anger. When people talked to them about, coming up with a plan or doing something, they were unable to really advocate for anything concrete. They were unable to say these are the changes we want, or these are the rules or regulations that we want changed. They were basically acting out in anger. One of the issues, main problems that they had was they decided to have kind of an informal governmental structure. And when they decided to do something, they would take a vote. And the vote had to be unanimous, which meant that they were rarely able to accomplish anything. There are many of us who believe that there were government infiltrators. And if you look at the history of the intelligence community in the United States, it would be hard to believe that there weren't government infiltrators into the movement who acted to disrupt it, acted to create chaos. But the reality of the Occupy movement was it was an acting out in anger. So they did not have a plan. They did not have goals. They knew they were angry. And so it was a movement that was destined to at some point flop, at some point to run out of steam, because they didn't know what they want. They didn't know where they were going. That was their, to me, that was their biggest problem, not knowing where they were going or what they really wanted to do.
After the spark of protests in New York, a wave of demonstrations started across the United States. Occupy encampments popped up and were set in major cities and towns, drawing diverse group of people who were angry and fed up with their economic state and blamed major corporations and the U.S. politicians who mostly came to power through the support of Wall Street and major corporations.
Shortly after midnight, more than 1,000 police dressed in riot gear filled the streets of downtown New York, moving in on the Occupy Wall Street camp, bringing heavy equipment and a no-nonsense attitude.
All persons must temporarily leave the park. If you refuse to immediately remove your property from the park or refuse to leave the park, you'll be subject to arrest.
Some experts believe that the lack of leadership in the Occupy Wall Street movement was one of the major factors that it died down relatively young. However, it impacted the 2012 presidential election, and politicians had to at least pretend that they understood the people's concerns. Candidates from both major parties were addressing issues like income equality and corporate influence in their campaign.
I would say the biggest internal problem was that there was a lot of foundation money pouring in from liberal Zionist NGOs like the Ford Foundation and entities that are tied to the U.S. What is it called? The National Endowment for Democracy and to George Soros. And that there were a lot of people that were being paid to be part of the Occupy Wall Street protest. And as a result, they were very careful to guide it in ways that it was not a threat to the U.S. power structure. At the time Occupy Wall Street was taking place, Libya was being bombed by the United States and NATO. There was almost no talk of that in the Occupy Wall Street protest movement whatsoever. There was an attempt to link the Occupy Wall Street protest movement with the call from Zionist settlers for more expansion of the settlements. There was also an attempt to link Occupy Wall Street with the efforts to destabilize Libya and Syria and Iran and Russia and China and other countries and link it with the color revolution apparatus from around the world. That was the main internal problem. The main external problem.
The Occupy Wall Street movement also had a ripple effect beyond the borders of the United States. Protests inspired by the movement occurred in numerous countries, especially Western nations such as the United Kingdom, Canada, Spain, and Australia. These global protests were often linked by shared sentiment of economic inequality and discontent with political elites. The international response demonstrated the interconnectedness of social and economic issues in the world.
You know, I can't say that the Occupy Wall Street movement itself inspired similar movements around the world. I can say that I believe that one of the things that happened as a result of 2008 and to some extent the pushback in 2008, the anger over the response of a neoliberal government, which decided that when the banks crashed and the people crashed economically, that this government would bail the banks out and leave the people to suffer.
The U.S. that prides itself and poses as a beacon for freedom of speech witnessed major police crackdown on Occupy Wall Street demonstrators. In New York, the police used excessive force in removing the protesters camping at Zuccotti Park, destroying and throwing out close to 6,000 of people's library books that was set up in the camp, containing books which were mostly donated by people for the public to read.
I would say that the main movement died quite fast, okay? By February 2012, the main places like London, Washington, D.C., as I said, maybe 5 minutes before, just died out. So the main movement did not last very long. And what factors contributed to its decline in prominence? I would say the celebration of horizontality, the absence of leaders, and maybe a certain infiltration by the FBI quite soon within the movement, let's say during the first months.
In Boston, Massachusetts, the police arrested hundreds of demonstrators during the occupation of Dewey Square, and in Los Angeles, California, at least 200 people were arrested when the LAPD cleared the occupied LA encampment around the City Hall. What made the movement lose prominence?
I think the main reason it declined in prominence was the Democrats no longer found it useful. The Democrats used it to get the energy going in the lead up to the 2012 elections. I was part of the protests that happened in Charlotte, North Carolina. I remember how, during those protests, Barack Obama and the Democratic Party very much wanted Occupy Wall Street tents and Occupy Wall Street encampment to be set up near the Democrat convention so they could film it. And they very much wanted to use the energy of the Occupy Wall Street movement to defeat the Republicans in 2012. The Republicans had their mass movement called the Tea Party. And so in order to maintain a kind of a populist image and the idea that they were fighting for the working class, the Democrats had to kind of create the aesthetic or the illusion that they were building a mass movement as well. And Occupy Wall Street served that purpose for the Democratic Party. And after that, it didn't really have a reason to exist. There was again, a lack of ideology, a lack of any clear demands or central authority. And so because of that, it was able to just kind of fade away almost as instantly as it had sprung up, and that the role of Silicon Valley and social media in both creating Occupy Wall Street and then deleting Occupy Wall Street from the conversation cannot be overlooked. There was a huge amount of manipulation by the social media tech giants to create and destroy Occupy Wall Street for their own purposes.
The Occupy Wall Street movement that began in September 2011 in New York City marked a significant moment in contemporary social and political activism. It was a protest that ignited discussions on economic inequality, corporate influence in politics, and the concentration of wealth. Some politicians like Bernie Sanders tried to run on the waves of such movements, but were unsuccessful partly because they are part of the establishment and millionaires themselves.
Well, the one thing that the Occupy movement was able to do was it was able to redirect the discourse to economic prosperity and bring the conversation out about oligarchy. One of the things that they talked about was the 99%, basically being the working class, the working poor, and the poor versus the 1%, the extremely wealthy. And in creating that conversation, particularly in a country like the United States that pushes a neoliberal economic order and a very oppressive economic order, in bringing out a conversation that pitted the majority of the people against a small, dominant, ruling elite, that then created new conversations about addressing the income inequality. Before, the income inequality wasn't part of a discussion. They brought it out. Their discussion about the 99% versus the 1% changed the discourse. So I think it was very healthy. It was a very good thing to happen. It was a movement. Maybe it wasn't destined to be able to make a change as a group or as a movement, but it did change the conversation to the 99% versus the 1%. And of course,
the Occupy Wall Street movement, while no longer physically present in Zuccotti Park, sparked important conversations and drew attention to the issues of income inequality and corporate power in the United States. Its legacy continues to influence discussions on economic justice and the role of financial institutions in shaping society. However, 12 years since its inception, large corporate banks are still being bailed out by the government, they're running on greed, and have no responsibility toward the society.
Quran Quest, a program on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Quran Quest, where we study the verses of the Quran to learn from them and to practice them in our daily lives. And to help us with that, we have, as always, our dear and beloved Brother Habib. Brother Habib, salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for sharing your time with us.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's always an honor and a pleasure.
So we are on chapter 70, Al-Ma'arij, Surah Al-Ma'arij, with Brother Habib. And we're on verse 34 onwards. Let's listen to these verses and we'll be right back for today's discussion. Don't go away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
والذين هم على صلاتهم يحافظون.
And those who carefully maintain their prayer.
أولئك في جنات مكرمون.
They will be in gardens, honored.
فما للذين كفروا